From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Paul Sullivan's interest in the idea of being clutch was personal. A rough childhood left him with the pressure of having to succeed because he didn't really have a backup plan. And he has succeeded, that is. But he says there's one area in his life where he still chokes, on the golf course. This frustration made him wonder, and he began to think deeply about clutch performers, how they could react in pressure-filled situations. Two questions persisted as he worked through the idea. Why are some people so much better under pressure than others? And can people be clutch if they're not regularly in high-pressure situations? Today in the program, Paul Sullivan is joining us to talk about what he's learned about the clutch players and the chokers. When you think of someone who is clutch under pressure, most of us immediately think of sports. And often it's the sweaty palms moment in those last seconds we think of. But the writer and journalist Paul Sullivan says in sports, there's often the element of luck. And clutch is not about luck. It's about hard work. Well, it's about a lot of things. Sullivan has written a book on what it means to be clutch under pressure. He set out, he says, to discover what made some people great under pressure and how they succeeded when others choked. Wanted to find out who were clutch across a range of professions, and he deconstructs just how it works, clutch, why some people excel under pressure and others don't. The book is called Clutch, and today in the program, Paul Sullivan is joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. Questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Paul Sullivan writes the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times. He previously worked as a reporter, an editor, a columnist for the Financial Times. Clutch is his first book, and he's joining us today from his home in Stamford, Connecticut. And Paul Sullivan, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Doug, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I guess we should start with your own interest in the subject, because it's quite personal. In the book, you say you've always been fascinated by clutch performers, and I guess it started with kind of a rough childhood.
Well, as I say, there are only two types of people who'd write a book like this. The first is a person who had glorious success in athletics or life and was always coming through under pressure. The second is the opposite, the person who choked often when the stakes were high, and that was me. When I was growing up, you're right, I had a fairly mediocre childhood, I think is a polite way to say it, but one of the things I loved to do was to play golf with my grandfather. He played a huge role in my life, and we'd play golf on, you know, the public courses with his buddies, and did pretty well, got a job working at a golf course, I got better at it, and I got to a point where I thought I was really quite good. I shoot, you know, in the 70s, single-digit handicap, and so I started entering a few tournaments, and invariably, I'd prepare and prepare and prepare, and in that tournament, I would choke horribly, and time and time again, and unfortunately, this continued on into adulthood when people would invite me to their nice golf courses to play a round of golf. I'd get so excited, show up, and promptly choke, and that's what fascinated me, or that's at least what I remembered when I was so fascinated by the beginning of the financial crash in 2007-2008. You know, as a business journalist, I watched otherwise bright, successful, talented people fail under pressure, and I really wanted to know why. And I remembered what it was like as a kid, as an adult, playing golf. And I said, you know, look, at the end of the day, I'm not a professional golfer. It doesn't matter if I choke on a golf course, but it does matter if you're running a bank or if you're an attorney or if you're a politician or, you know, even for many of us, if you're an athlete and you fail in that clutch moment. And that was really the genesis of this book.
As you interviewed people whom you considered clutch, it's interesting how few of them themselves thought about themselves as clutch. They didn't really think about it like that. And maybe that's one of the components about being clutch is we're not overthinking it. And we'll get to that point as we move along here as well.
Yeah, I mean, what was remarkable was that the people who joke again and again and again, more often than not, thought they were really fantastic under pressure. And these are the people who say, you know, the more pressure, the better. I love it. I thrive under pressure. And you're absolutely right. I mean, what I found was, you know, be it you know, an attorney like David Boies, or a great actor like Larry Clark, or, you know, some of the people I talked to in the Secret Service, they didn't think of the pressure. And that's how I came up with my definition, at least, of clutch. And that's the ability to do what you can do under normal circumstances under pressure. And that's what's every one of these people. And the heartening part for me is, one, none of these people were born great under pressure. They weren't born clutch. And two, they worked really hard at it. And so as the years went on of researching and writing this book, I said, well, this is you know, more interesting than I thought, because it's actually something that I believe that people can learn. Mm.
You talk about how you began with preconceived ideas about clutch. What were the ideas that you started with, and how did they evolve as you started talking to people and understanding it more?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know that they're preconceived ideas so much as they were a set of questions. Because I've been a reporter for 15 years, you know, since I left college, and you know, any halfway decent reporter wants to know why, and they want to know how, and that's how I really started. I mean, watching, you know, 2008 was really a perfect time to start a book like this. And, you know, while the economy continued to do worse and worse and worse, from my perspective, it actually became an even better time to write the book, because there was just so much pressure everywhere. And so for me, it was, you know, trying to figure out, you know, the why and the how. And over the course of doing it, I found that, you know, regardless of whether you were a star athlete, a great businessman, an attorney, an actor, whatever, an entrepreneur, a parent, that the same five traits applied to everyone who was great under pressure. And conversely, as we'll probably talk later, the same three qualities, people who choke habitually possess these same three qualities. And that was interesting to me, that there was this level of consistency across professions, as it were. Mm.
Well, we're going to work through all of those as we go. I did want to ask you about it's interesting that you see a lot of – and usually they're in the kind of self-help section of you know, bookstores – a lot of kind of new age ideas related to mind power in terms of, you know, responding under pressure. What do you make of those? Because you talk about those in the book as one of those things you didn't really trust.
No, I dismiss them, and I dismiss them quite strongly. You know, on a personal level, when I was trying to be a better golfer, I read every single one of them, and I thought, you know, why aren't these things working? But on a more, you know, rigorous level, over the course of doing this research, I realized that, I mean, so many of these people were really just grinders, and they were all mentally tough. They all had the ability to just, you know, focus on the moment as we work through these traits, and they just were so great at it. And I thought, you know what, if it was just a question of them being mentally tough, they'd always be great. Yeah. Because they are so, you know, they are so accomplished. They are so good at what they do. And I took it in the last chapter. It was a lot of fun for me because I spent some time with some golfers on the PGA Tour. And I was at this one tournament called the Players Championship, which is in Florida in the spring every year. And you stand on the driving range and you watch these guys. There are 125 guys who are qualified to be full members of the PGA Tour. These guys are all amazing. On a driving range, they can hit any shot imaginable. On the course, it's not always the same. Now, yet people think, well, maybe they're not mentally tough, but I argue that they had to win tournaments at every single stage along that spectrum to get to the PGA Tour. So it was a lot more than just plain old, you know, mental toughness, plain old, you know, people talk about being in the zone, people talk about flow, people talk about, you know, a mental edge. But the reality I found was that it was both much less sort of mythical, but also much more practical at the end of the day for the people who are really great under pressure.
I wanted to we should say that you also came into this with a kind of skepticism of the academic studies. They didn't seem to inform what you were after either, really, in some ways.
No, and I joke at the expense of at the beginning of the book, I joke at the expense of a well-known Nobel laureate in economics, a guy named Gary Becker. And I actually started off as a journalist. I went right to the University of Chicago to do some graduate work in history afterwards. And yeah, Becker's a brilliant guy. And he's come up. We won the Nobel Prize for his thinking into, you know, something called rational choice, being essentially, simply put, if we have enough information, we'll make the right choices. And I thought, well, this is a very elegant, very interesting theory, but in practice, it doesn't work because we're not really all that rational. And so-called behavioral economists have proved this. But I thought, you know, if such a beautiful theory as this could be disproven in practice, I couldn't, in good conscience, give a lot of credit to these academic studies. These psychologists who would have people in a lab and say, okay, try to make this putt. They always, you know, people love to use golf. Try to make this 10-foot putt. Yeah. The guy would try, and then he said, well, okay, now if you make that putt, we'll give you $10. And they try to argue that, you know, or $20 or whatever, you know, was a significant dollar amount for that person. And they would argue that, see, you know, when we add this layer of pressure and they fail. And I thought, you know what, this is all interesting, but nobody has ever been clutch in a laboratory. Nobody's ever choked in a laboratory. Why? Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. You know, when you want to come through is when you're giving a presentation in front of a bunch of people, or when you're playing tennis with your, you know, best friend / you know, arch rival at the game. That's when it matters. And it doesn't matter if there's $20 riding on it or nothing. That's the moment when you start to feel pressure. And that's real pressure, and it's not, you know, laboratory pressure. And so that's why I thought, from my point of view at least, I had to go out into the field. I had to almost be sort of, you know, more an anthropologist of pressure and find people who were great and who were awful at under pressure and really figure out why for the book, at least in my view, to have any value to a wider audience.
It seems like the vehicle for doing this, if you're talking to people who don't really consider themselves clutch, you've got to get them telling stories, because then I guess you can sort of break down how it works. And that's really what the book is. It's this collection of stories that helps you sort of go down these principles. And so let's start with a story. One of the first principles you talk about is this idea of focus. And one of the stories you use is this story about the 1998 deposition of the billionaire Bill Gates by this attorney who's sort of the central figure in the story, and David Boies. And he's representing the United States in this antitrust case against Microsoft. Okay, so I've set you up for that. Now tell the story, because this is the idea that sort of gets us into focus.
Sure. And so, just as you said, this is, you know, the biggest antitrust trial of the 90s. Yep. But it's being compared to, you know, Gates at the time is being compared to Rockefeller and Standard Oil, and it's just, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the U.S. government to do something. And David Boies, who is just an amazing litigator, gets hired to represent the United States. And in this deposition, he has, you know, on the first day, he's got, you know, Gates up there in the box. And Gates is just, he looks like Gates. He's very arrogant, very self-assured. He's got a can of Coke in his hand. He's not really paying attention. And Boies starts to ask him very simple questions. You know, Mr. Gates, can you define the term killer app? Gates says, no, I can't. And he says, well, Mr. Gates, it says on this Microsoft dictionary that you're the editor. And he gets very angry to be called out. Day two, he says, you know, Mr. Gates, in this email here, you said the following about competition. Yes. But in this presentation to shareholders, you said exactly the opposite. Can you explain the difference? Well, that's just how it is. Well, by day six, Bill Gates is essentially sitting in the box, rocking back and forth, and he can't even look at Boies. And this is something that I remember seeing this for the first time, you know, when it happened in the late 90s. And when I got a chance to sit down with David Boies early last year, I said, you know, David, how did you do this? How did you come up with this strategy? And he said, well, I had two choices. I could have concentrated on the details of the case. I could have concentrated on the browser technology. I mean, that's what the whole suit was about. It was about Microsoft was, you know, bundling its browser into its operating system, so you didn't have a choice except to use it. Classic antitrust. And he said, and Boies said, but the risk there was that if I just concentrated on the technology, it would just take one techie from Microsoft to come in and tell the judge, look, judge, we just do it this way because it works better. That's it. And the judge probably would have agreed because at the time it's complicated stuff. What Boyce decided to do instead was he calls these morality plays, but essentially what he did was he focused on something more tangible, something that anybody could understand. And in the case of Bill Gates, he focused on credibility. And that's why he was asking the questions about defining terms. He was asking about, you know, to explain, you know, why something was different in an email as a presentation, because he told me, like, he was willing to concede that Bill Gates and all the Microsoft people knew far more about technology than David Boies and the U.S. government did. But if he eroded all the credibility that Gates had, whatever he said, the judge wouldn't believe it. As he said, you know, you could know much more about technology than I do, but if the judge doesn't believe a word that comes out of your mouth, well, it's irrelevant. And this is something that Boies has used throughout his career. He's one of the, you know, great litigators of our time, and he's been wildly successful in cases that have absolutely nothing to do with each other. Microsoft antitrust. Well, he made his name early on defending CBS against General Westmoreland. That was a libel trial. Recently, he did the Prop 8 case in California over gay marriage. That's civil rights. He's working on the divorce of the McCourts, who the family that owns the Dodgers. That's a simple divorce case. Many people remember him for Bush v. Gore. He was on the Gore side. That is, you know, a great political case. You know, the county commissioner's race on steroids. They're all so incredibly different. And I asked him, you know, how did you tie all this together? And he said, it's a morality play. It's always focusing on the ultimate goal. And so for him, under pressure, it wasn't, you know, how he would win the trial, how he would go about doing it. It was that he would. And so he had this strategy, and that kept him, you know, focused ultimately. And one of the good things was that he was litigating a big trial in New York two summers ago. It was a lawsuit, AIG, the insurer, versus SECO, a former subsidiary of it. And I actually got to sit in the courtroom for a month and watch him do it. And, you know, we have this image in our mind of what a master litigator is like. And Boies isn't that image. I mean, he looks like your fifth grade social studies teacher. But, I mean, that's one of his great skills, because he just talks to people and he's always telling them a story. And, you know, in that case, AIG SECO, his morality tale was about keeping track of your money, because it was a very complicated trust case involving over $4 billion, which nobody would understand. Nobody without a background in how a trust is created would understand it. But everybody understands keeping track of what's yours. We all get a bank statement. We get a mortgage bill, all of these things. And so that was his focus. And so he always focuses on the biggest thing possible instead of, you know, concentrating on the small details that he believes would really bog him down under pressure.
So the idea is finding a mechanism or a vehicle for his focus. He's got to find – and the story is the way he does that.
Yeah, and as he told me, he said earlier that these people don't think of themselves as being great under pressure. And, you know, he joked with me. He said, you know, look, in Bush v. Gore, if I woke up every morning and thought, okay, today the fate of the nation rests on my shoulders, I'd never get out of bed. And we had a good laugh about that. But he said – he's a big tennis player. And he said, you know, when I'm in the courtroom after years of preparation, I know that it matters, because I wouldn't be there if it didn't. You know, in this case last summer, he estimated that the two sides had earned somewhere between $80 and $120 million in legal fees. And there's a lot riding on it. It was $4 billion. There's a lot riding on Bush v. Gore. So he says, I never think this is the serve that is going to win the U.S. Open. I always think this is just another serve in the match. And that's how he keeps that focus going over, you know, these trials last for months and months and months. And that's how he keeps it going. And you know, he also calls it, you know, being in that bubble. He doesn't want to leave that bubble that would anyway take his focus away from whatever the case happens to be.
But you also say focus is not the same thing as concentration. There's a difference.
Yeah. You know, an easy way to think about it, because people will say, well, what's the difference? Or, you know, I can focus on things. Think of it in terms of, you know, concentration is a flashlight. focus is a laser beam. Or, you know, maybe for some people who are, you know, driving as they're listening to this today, you know, concentration is driving your car on the highway. Focus is driving a $300,000 Ferrari on a racetrack at 200 miles an hour, and it belongs to your friend. You know, they're similar, but there's enough of a distinction to really make it matter under pressure.
Paul Sullivan is joining us. His book is called Clutch: Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it means to be clutch when the pressure is on. This often makes us think of athletes draining a three or sinking a putt when it matters most, but the New York Times columnist Paul Sullivan says anyone can be clutch. He says succeeding under pressure isn't an innate gift, it's a skill. His book is called Clutch, and he's joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Anne, who's joining us in Zion Canyon in Utah. Anne, welcome.
Hi. I am very curious that political pressure or legal pressure or anything like that is one subject, but my daughter's an ER nurse, and I've always wondered, how do you deal with that kind of pressure where if you choke, it's a life or death situation? Has this author looked into that end of the question?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're absolutely right. People often ask me, you know, in the course of all these interviews, who do you think is the greatest under pressure? And I said, well, it's the Secret Service guys and the Army Special Forces troops that I talk to. But then I always caution them. I say, you know, you can't really expect to emulate that. I mean, they're in a unique, terrifying environment. And I said, you know, a better example is, you know, a doctor or a nurse in an ER, because it is absolutely life and death. But, you know, I found, and there was in an earlier version of the book, there was a whole chapter on a doctor, and unfortunately it got taken out. But it, you're absolutely right. I mean, an ER nurse, I mean, it's the nexus of life and death. You don't know what's going to come in the door from one moment to the next. But it's the same principles, because your daughter as a nurse is highly, highly trained. She knows how to do all the things she has to do under normal conditions. She knows how to handle any type of injury she could possibly see. And then she does it under the pressure of this person has just rolled into the emergency room with whatever may happen, you know, a knife wound or a brain hemorrhage, whatever you can think of. And she very quickly applies those skills. And, you know, just to kind of whiz through the five traits that matter, we were talking before the break about focus. That gets you in the frame of mind to be great under pressure. Followed by that is discipline. Discipline helps you stay the course. The third, though, is adaptability, right? Because you may have one plan. Say your daughter is tending to somebody with a seemingly severe injury in the emergency room, but somebody comes in with a worse injury. Well, they've got to adapt what they're doing. They have to reallocate resources. The fourth trait is being present. What that means exactly is you have to only be, you know, only be focused on that particular moment under pressure. You can't think of the last time somebody was wheeled into the ER and you either saved their life or you didn't save their life, because the only thing that matters is that person that is there in front of you. And the fifth trait is what I call the push and pull of fear and desire. And in an ER setting, it's obvious. It's, you know, it's people who have the desire to be successful at what they're doing, but are also driven by a healthy dose of fear that they could fail. Well, in an ER, somebody could die if you don't do the job. So it's very clear how that trait works. Mm.
When you talk about adaptability, this idea of adapting, you tell the story of an ambush in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq in 2004, and this is the story of Sergeant William Copeland. Talk about what he taught you about this idea of adapting.
Yeah, and Willie Copeland won the Navy Cross for what he did in battle, which is the second highest honor that the military gives out. And what fascinated me, and he was part of a Marine Recon battalion. Marine Recon is essentially the Marine version of the Navy SEALs or the Army Rangers. They're Army Special Forces. They're very elite, very highly trained. They go into particularly dangerous places all the time. And before, you know, starting this book, I don't know what listeners have, but I had a vision in my mind of these people being, you know, ex-football players or great lacrosse players or, you know, really the big, strong, tough guys. And Willie Copeland was exactly the opposite. I talked a lot with one of the guys who trained him, and he said, you know, Willie would sit around. Willie was from Utah. He would sit around and drink, you know, big gulp mugs of coffee. He would smoke cigarettes. He, you know, wanted to talk about the rodeo. He wasn't, you know, watching every single thing he ate. Yet, he had, you know, he kept up with everybody else. He may have been a skinny guy, but he was just as tough in all the training. And best of all for this guy who trained him was that Willie had the ability to figure things out. Something broke that couldn't fix an engine in a car. Willie could go over there and say, oh, well, let me take a look. And, you know, more often than not, figure out a way to fix it. And so fast forward, in this ambush, the Humvee in front of him takes fire, is disabled. He gets out, starts leading his men across the field. In the course of doing this, his commanding officer takes a bullet and is down. They have to call in, get some sort of medical support. Well, what does Willie do? He keeps going across the field. Why? Because the Iraqis are so entrenched. They've been waiting. I mean, this is a real ambush. They've been waiting for hours for somebody to come through there. And he starts lobbing grenades. He starts shooting, lobbing grenades, and tactically working his way across the field. Once he gets him dislodged, he pulls back. He allows all of his other men to be evacuated and stays with his commanding officer until somebody can airlift him out. Then he continues to retreat across the field himself. And it's amazing when you think about it, because all of these things that he was doing are completely separate. You know, he's running, he's throwing, he's thinking. It's not any one thing. But, and you know, in the citation, when he won the medal, he says, you know, there's nothing, of course, natural about running into fire. It's just what I did, and he's very humble about it. But it shows how incredible the training is of the Marine Recon unit, because he, you know, in that moment, all of his training came to bear. And obviously, they can't simulate that kind of pressure at the Marine Recon school. I mean, you can throw somebody in cold water at 4 a.m. You can, you know, wake them up, you know, in the middle of the night. You can do all these things, but you have to hope that they work, that they go to that next level. And, you know, Willie Copeland to me was just an amazing example of how those skills can be learned under normal circumstances and then, you know, applied under just an absolutely incredible amount of pressure.
You know, one thing that keeps coming up is how tangible all of this is, how that it's, as you've said, this is not an innate issue. It's something that it's about hard work. It's something tangible that you can actually get. One of our callers from Layton, John, wondered whether or not if it's learned behavior or if it's just kind of a personality. You say that it's learned. It's something you achieve.
Yeah, it's absolutely learned. And I didn't meet a single person, you know, in 2 years who was really great under pressure who said, you know, I've always been like this. And this includes, you know, an interview I had back in sort of late 2008 with Tiger Woods. This is, you know, a year before all of his personal problems came to light. And at that point, you know, Tiger was considered probably the, you know, the greatest golfer ever under pressure and maybe one of the great athletes of his age under pressure. You know, he had just won the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines. He won it, you know, in the 19th hole of an 18-hole playoff. You know, as soon as the tournament was over, he went in and had knee surgery. He was limping all around. He was wincing, yet he made one incredible shot after another. And when I was sitting across from him, I said, you know, Tiger, I've got to ask you, I mean, why are you so much better than everybody else under pressure? You know, what is it? And he said, well, I've just been there more often. And I said, well, Tiger, that's not a very satisfying answer. He says, no, think about it. I've been playing golf since I was 2. I've been competing in tournaments since I was 5. I have failed so often that people never saw me. I had that ability to work everything out under tournament pressure from an early age. So whereas many people, he had a good 10 years of tournament play under his belt compared to, you know, his contemporaries on the PGA Tour. And he emphasized that there was nothing. You know, he's a mentally tough guy. He's a smart guy, you know, personal problems aside. But it was always, you know, as he said, you know, working on those fundamentals, like being able to hit every single shot and know he could hit every single shot. But beyond that, when he hit a very bad shot, he was able to forget it. He was able to just say, okay, I now have to hit the next shot. And I would like to hit the shot from the fairway, but I'm actually going to have to hit it from behind this tree. And he would go and do that. But he practiced all those shots. So it was never, there was never going to be any surprise for Tiger. I mean, as a recreational golfer, many recreational golfers say, oh, I can't believe I hit the ball behind the tree. What do I do? Well, they don't know because they've never practiced it. Tiger Woods has practiced all of those shots from behind the tree. So he knows, you know, to him, it's another shot. Maybe it's, you know, he may be Sunday afternoon, he may be leading a tournament, but it's always just another shot. And when we get to that frame of thinking about things under pressure, it helps us a lot. Because if we hit a bad shot and then we grumble all the way down the fairway and think, God, I can't believe I hit it, well, then we end up hitting a second bad shot, as opposed to, well, I hit a bad shot, I now have to hit the next shot and let's move on. And it's that, as I was saying about David Boies, it's just another serve. It's that incremental, focusing on the incremental under pressure that will often, you know, lead to something far greater.
There's an and by the way, thanks very much for the call. 801-585 West is the number. There's an email that comes from Gary who brings up the book by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink: The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And Gary talks about how you know, Gladwell writes that that there's experience and there's training and knowledge, but it's, and that's what develops it, but there's a kind of a sense of intuition here, an intuitive judgment. What do you make of that? Because it seems that this tangible idea of hard work and, you know, training and discipline and all those kinds of things aren't really about intuition. So what do you make about that component?
Yeah, I mean, Gladwell's fascinating, and I don't think so much of Blink as I do the book after that, Outliers, in which he talks about, you know, 10,000 hours, and that, when that book first came out, a lot of people are talking about it. You know, he found, you know, people like, you know, all composers, great athletes, whatever it is, they had put in, you know, 10,000 hours of work. And it's a fascinating idea, but I say, you know, look, you could put in 10,000 hours of work as a gardener. You'd be a great gardener, but it doesn't mean you'd be good under pressure. And there's another idea that I talk about the last chapter of my book, more about what I think I call focus pressure, focus practice. And the idea being, you can never fully simulate the pressure of a moment. You just can't until you're there. And so in the context of golf, one of the coaches I talked to, he makes sure that instead of his players going out and hitting, you know, 10 shots with a single club, 10 shots with the next club, they only ever hit one shot per club. And then they move on. And whether they hit it well or not, they set up as if they're really on the golf course. And that gets their mind, gets everything feeling, their body, everything feeling like, okay, I'm on the driving range, but I might be on the golf course. And it helps them, because I see a lot of amateur golfers go to the driving range with the biggest bucket of balls they can buy, and they whack them all out, their driver, then they whack some more out. And it's totally useless, because then they get on the golf course and they say, boy, I hit it so well on the driving range, but I just always choke out here on the course. Well, actually, you haven't prepared properly. You haven't prepared properly to play a round of golf, whether or not there's any pressure. Because remember, you have to be able to do these things, you know, normally before you can expect to do them under pressure. So if you're just kind of, you know, if you're practicing in a sort of futile way, it's not going to translate to the course when you're just out there with your buddies. So it definitely is not going to then go to the next level and work when you're under a tremendous amount of pressure.
801-585 West, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Chris is joining us. He's in Baltimore. Chris, hi.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I asked you guys about the idea of intuition, I was telling your screener about my wife, who is she's a labor and delivery nurse, and she delivers babies every single day, and most of the time everything's fine and routine, but every once in a while there's some exigent circumstance that she anticipates, and it results in someone's life being saved, either the baby's or the mother's. And when she describes this to me, she says, there's no way that I would have known this would have happened. I just somehow understood it or intuited it. And I wonder if you might parse that down a little bit from the abstract.
Paul Sullivan, you think it's more that she's just trained?
Yeah, I think, you know, as the caller set it up, I mean, his wife has been doing this for so long. You could argue that she's seen everything. I mean, that's what, I talked to our own, my wife's OBGYN doctor. He's delivered over 9,000 babies. You can call it intuition, or you can just say he's got a ton of experience doing this. I mean, nothing is ever going to rattle him because he has seen it all before. And maybe it's intuition, or maybe he knows that, you know, if X happens, then that means the cause is probably Y. It's this, you know, decades of experience just delivering babies normally when nothing goes wrong. You go in, you go into labor, you have the baby, great. But there are those moments when that doesn't happen. And a person with some of this tremendous experience will know what to do. Why? Because they've seen it all before. And they have that training, but they've also, you know, put that training into practice.
Chris, glad you called. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Paul Sullivan is with us. His book is called Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Paul Sullivan. We're talking about his new book. It's called Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Bryce is joining us in Salt Lake. Bryce, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I had a question about whether or not you could dream and experience the same amount of pressure that would exist in real life, because you wake up still feeling the same after effects as though it had actually happened. And if so, if hypnotism could create the same result of being able to experience that kind of pressure you're talking about.
That's interesting, Paul Sullivan. So if you can't recreate it in a laboratory, can you do it in a dream state?
I'll say this is the first question I've received since the book came out that's baffled me. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try to make up an answer. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, Bryce, good. Write your own book. That's a great idea. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. I wanted to talk to you about fear and desire, another one of those components that you write about. Let me ask about, it's an extraordinary factor in making crucial decisions under pressure. Talk about the study conducted by researchers at the University of Bath in England, this idea of the force of fear is how they put it.
Yeah, it's all set around what for many people is a very terrifying place, the gym. And the study started off, they had a bunch of students, and they thought, what type of incentives or disincentives can we give them to go or not to go to the gym? And so they got some volunteers, divided up the group, and they told one group that they look great, they're in fantastic shape, but if you go to the gym a bit more often, you'll become healthier, you'll get in even better shape than you are now, but you're in good shape. They took the other group and they said, you know what, you're in horrible shape, awful shape. You need to really go to the gym, because if you don't, bad things are going to happen to you. And what they found is that the group that was told they needed to go, even though these groups were equal, there's no, you know, one wasn't a bunch of overweight people and the other a bunch of very in shape people, they were divided equally. The group that was told that if they went to the gym, they would just be healthier, went a lot more often than the group that said, you know, you're in pretty good shape, but if you go, you'll be in even better shape. And then they took it a step further. After that one group had been going for a while, the group that was told that they needed to go to get into better shape, they told them, you know what, you're in pretty good shape now, you know, but you're almost there. If you just keep it up, if you just, you know, go one more day a week, it'd be fine, but you're already in great shape now, you've made great progress, well, that group stopped going as much. And I use it as to kind of tee up the discussion on, you know, fear and desire. And you know, they obviously had a desire to be in good shape. Both groups did. That was, you know, that was clear. But one group was motivated by the other component of a fear of looking horrible, fear of being in awful shape. And I take this little nugget and I expand it into a discussion on what drives entrepreneurs. And one of the entrepreneurs I talked to is Bernie Marcus, who founded the Home Depot back in the 1970s. And, you know, at that point, he was in his late 40s. He'd been let go from his previous job. He had a wife, a family, and he decided to start this company with his partner in Atlanta. His partner is from Queens. He was from Newark. They had never been to Atlanta, but they did some research and said, this is going to be good. And then he drew all these other people down to Atlanta, these great executives, and convinced the executives and their spouses that they needed to come to Atlanta. And then he raised all kinds of money, and he opened two Home Depots in Atlanta. And he says, you know, at one point I said, I can't believe this. You know, all of these people are counting on me. And so like any good entrepreneur, that he had a desire for success. He believed that his idea for a giant hardware store would work, that it was necessary. But unlike a lot of them who spiral out of control, we can think of, you know, Mozilla at Countrywide. There's a whole list, you know, the Enron guys, the HealthSouth guys, the list goes on. Unlike people like that, Bernie Marcus had this fear that if he didn't stay focused, if he wasn't disciplined, if he didn't adapt under pressure, it could all fail. Yeah. And all of these people were counting on him. And so to make sure that he never became the CEO who walked into the office and took the elevator straight to the 30th floor, he named his management style Running Scared. And even when he was on his way to becoming a billionaire, he never stopped working on the floors. He never stopped talking to the associates, to the managers. Why? Because he never wanted to let all of his success go to his head. He always wanted to have that little bit of, you know, little bit of fear, the fear that, you know, this could all go away, even at the point when, you know, it wasn't going away. He made more money than he could ever spend in a life. He created something that is now all over the country that people go to every day to buy stuff they need. He never wanted to, you know, get too big for his britches. He never wanted to just think of all the glory he was getting from starting and running the Home Depot. He always had the fear that, you know, companies fail, things can go wrong. And for him, it was a very healthy check to keep him going.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Todd is with us in American Fork, Utah. Todd, hi.
Doug, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I had a quick question. I'm an airline pilot, and naturally we do an awful lot of training to ideally be prepared and make the right decision in the clutch moments. And anybody who's even looked in a cursory way at airline accidents, they involve pilots of all skill levels, even extremely qualified, very, very supposedly clutch people who maybe have made those good decisions all along. In your discussion before about, well, maybe somebody has seen everything or has so much experience, isn't it true, though, that in the end, anybody is capable of making that human mistake and not reacting correctly? Question. Doesn't matter your skill level or experience.
Absolutely. I mean, the opposite of being clutch isn't always that you choked. It could be quite simply that you did a bad job. Just as, you know, the opposite of being a choker isn't that you're clutch. It could just be doing a good job. I mean, I think I make the distinction in the book that, you know, if you're a baseball team or a football team, you know, you're used to losing. You want to win, but you accept that you lose. What you don't want to do is fail under pressure. And, you know, an airline pilot, you're absolutely right. I mean, planes don't crash that often. Some pilots are able to avert disaster, and some don't. But I don't think you're saying that everybody who gets behind the controls of a commercial airplane in America is equally adept at being a pilot. Some are naturally going to be better than others. Some have more hours than others. Some are just better pilots. They've had better training. They're better at it. And a question I got last week at a talk I did at my alma mater was about, you know, Sully Sullenberger, you know, the Miracle on the Hudson, this guy who, you know, lands this aircraft in the Hudson River. Nobody dies. He's a hero. And somebody said, well, you know, how did he train for that? I said, well, you know, given the economics of the airline industry right now, they certainly don't allow pilots to crash land planes in rivers, so that'd be prohibitively expensive. But if we think back, you know, Sully said that when he was at the Air Force Academy, he was a great glider pilot. Like he just had an amazing amount of skill with glider planes. He knew how to pilot a plane, you know, without power. And, you know, could he do that landing again? Maybe, who knows? But he did it once. And I'd like to think that on some level he drew back on that training, on that experience he had at the Air Force Academy flying glider planes.
Glad you called, Todd. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. An email from David. David tells a story about he has this corporate career where he has to stand in front of lots of people, and usually he doesn't have a difficult time doing it, but he tells the story in this email about presenting this speech, I guess it is, in front of this big crowd, and the whole company, in fact. The crowd size, he writes, the concept actually made a difference in my mind and in my actions. And he tells about the microphone really shaking hard. It really took him off guard. And I wonder if that works into this idea of overthinking, because that's one of those traits that you talk about for people, forgive me, David, who choke.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a very specific term for what happened to David, stage fright. It's terrifying. So many, you know, people who are incredibly accomplished at what they're doing can't bear the idea of talking in front of a crowd. And, you know, I can tell a personal story here, and that was, you know, over the summer, a friend of mine was a president of this little organization. He was having a lunch for 70 people, and he said, you know, I know your book hasn't come out yet, but would you like to come and talk to this group? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And I got up there, and, you know, I'd prepared for it. I wrote out the whole talk, and, you know, I thought, you know, okay, you know, everything I was going to say, I was ready. I timed it. I knew it was going to be exactly 45 minutes and the days and days of preparation. And I got up there, and, you know, having written the book on being clutch, I completely bombed. And about, you know, 15 minutes into this talk, I said, good God, I wish I could start over. I wish I could tear up this piece of paper and start over. And I thought about it. I said, you know, why am I not good at this? And, well, I got back to, I don't give a lot of talks. I don't get up there and give a lot of talks. And so I said, well, I want to be better at this. So I asked around some folks, and they recommended this coach out in San Francisco. So I flew out there and spent a couple days with him, and it was invaluable because I'm good under the pressure of a deadline, you know, turning in my column every week at the New York Times, the deadline of being a journalist, the deadline of writing a book, it didn't mean that I was going to that skill was going to translate. I don't give a lot. I didn't at that time. I give a lot of speeches now, but I didn't give a lot of speeches then. So why would I expect it to translate? And he helped me immensely overcome, you know, not so much my fear. I wasn't afraid so much. I just to get past the mistakes I made. And for big crowds, one of the things that he told me is, look at individual people. You're up there talking, and it doesn't matter if you're talking to 20 people, 200 people, or, you know, 1,000 people. You're just talking. And I found it's helped me immensely just to pick out individual people and for, you know, two or three sentences, talk to them. I don't use notes anymore. I just get up and talk to them for two or three sentences, and I talk to somebody else for two or three sentences. And it's a conversation, and it's a much different feeling. And, you know, the overthinking part was, boy, did I overthink that first speech. But now I feel it's much more like the fourth chapter of my book, being present, in which I tell through the story of this actor, Larry Clark, a Law and Order actor who got this great stage role, and talk to him about, you know, how he prepares. And that was a much more a positive experience for me to sort of, you know, get up there and to learn, you know, the right way to go and speak to an audience.
Well, also one of the things you talk about in the chapter on being present is putting aside the baggage of your past and personal experiences. How does that play out?
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, every night's a different night. I mean, that's what, you know, I learned from Larry Clark. I mean, he was he was on Law and Order for years, and you've all seen him on in movies and in shows. He's a really great character actor. But he was incredibly talented as a student. You know, he went to school outside of Baltimore, and, you know, he had his Actors Equity card at 19, and he for about 10 years, he really let that early success go to his head, and he wasn't doing very well. And it was only after he literally crashed and burned horribly in this audition. I tell a story in the book in which he was auditioning for this Las Vegas review, $5,000 a week at a time when he was, waiting tables for, maybe $100 a night. And he just kind of strolled in there thinking, I'm great, I can do this. And he hadn't prepared at all. And he was instead thinking of all the other times when he'd sung so well with a piano. But in this case, he hadn't sung with a piano in, I think he says, 6 months or a year, totally out of practice. And that was a wake-up call for him. And so now, I talk about in the context of this play Streamers by David Rabe. Larry Clark had the key role in the play. And I asked him, how do you do it night after night? And particularly, how do you do it when one night it is either fantastic or it's horrible? And he said, well, none of that matters, because every night is a different night. And I go out there and I try to deliver the play that David Rabe has written the best way I can, but I try to connect with the audience. And I try to feel what they're feeling. I try to, if it's a great audience, I play off that emotion. If it's not, I try to reach them in a different way. But the key is, he's always thinking about that night. And so, the caller, David, when he gets up and gives another speech, he can't be thinking about that speech in front of the 500 people in which he choked. He's got to forget about it. It doesn't, it's done. It doesn't matter anyway. He's got to think about the whatever the next speech is that he gives to however many people it is, and say, look, he's the expert on whatever he's talking about. He knows it. Nobody's going to stump him. He just goes out there and he tries to connect with the audience. And that's what public speakers do. And that's what, stage actors do night after night after night.
Paul Sullivan. His book is called Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. Joined us by phone from his home in Stamford, Connecticut. Paul, thanks very much for the time.
Great. Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.